here with this week's hottest stories in the investment world. This is Zach's Friday Finish Line.
Hello, and welcome to an exclusive interview from the Zach's Friday Finish Line team. Today, we are going to be joined by Jamie Anderson to discuss the Latin American real estate market.
Jamie is the managing principal and co-founder of Tierra Funds, LLC, as well as Tierra Capital Partners, LLC, a private investment firm. Tierra Funds rolled out the first ETF that invests solely in real estate investment trusts and real estate operating companies in the Latin America region, Tierra XP America Real Estate, LARE. The Tierra XP Latin America Real Estate ETF, trades under the ticker LARE, is the first fund of its kind that invests in real estate investment trusts, or REITs, and real estate operating companies, or REOCs, in the Latin America region. What prompted you to launch this ETF?
Thanks, Maddie. It's great to be with you guys. So we looked at the market a few years ago. Our background is actually Latin America real estate private equity investing. We've been working in the region since the early 90s, and we looked at the market about 5 years ago, and we saw a fundamental shift in terms of where local institutional investors were sort of driving change, and that change was essentially shifting away from direct investing, so private equity type investing in real estate, to the public markets. And the main reason is twofold. One is local institutional capital, like pension funds, insurance companies, etc., were really not a factor 10 years ago. That's completely changed. They're a major factor in the local capital markets today. And then the second opportunity that we saw was that as a result of local institutional capital, you had a sort of a renaissance in IPOs for previously privately held real estate companies, including a number of REIT IPOs. And so you didn't have this opportunity to organize exposure to public real estate, you know, 5-10 years ago. Nobody had done it. We stepped back and we said, you know what? We know the real estate markets really well, and we know a lot of the players, and we think that this growth profile is quite attractive. The benefits of a public strategy versus a private strategy are self-evident. You know, one is, in a public strategy, you're liquid. Two, you're getting paid currently. So in other words, a dividend yield is going to accrue to the public equity investor. And then three, you can diversify. And so, you know, what's happened, we listed in December of 2015, and, you know, our returns, our total return, I think, since inception is just north of 45% in dollars. We're up almost 21.5% this year. Last year, we were up about the same 22%, something like that. But we paid a 13% dividend yield. And we're really pleased with the performance, because I think what we've shown is that not only was this trend, this identifying a trend in the marketplace, correct, but two, you know, the returns have been phenomenal. So that's essentially it.
So we try to cover a lot of different stories on our show, but I think it would be fair to say that many of our listeners might not be familiar with the real estate market in Latin America. Keeping this maybe to draw a comparison to something we are familiar with, could you maybe highlight the three biggest differences between the region and the U.S. real estate market?
Absolutely. So just to give some context, the U.S. REIT market is about a $1 trillion market cap space. In Latin America, it's about $75 billion, so it's obviously much smaller. But that said, you've got probably 150 listed public real estate companies in the region, and they trade in terms of liquidity profile, which is usually something that investors are interested in. They trade almost $1 billion a week. So there's size, there's liquidity, and more importantly, as I referenced earlier, there's diversification. So the three main differences, I think, you know, number one, Latin America is in the early innings of its real estate cycle. And if I drew a comparison, I would say it's kind of like the U.S. in the early, mid-1980s, you know, where the REIT structure was relatively new. But also from a growth standpoint, you know, the U.S. was in a very different point of development in the 1980s than it is today. So in Latin America, that growth profile is a very unique difference versus the U.S. because Latin America, in many ways, is just getting started in terms of demand for real estate. The second difference is probably that global investors, in contrast with the U.S., are very underexposed to local real estate equities in Latin America. The main drivers I mentioned earlier is really local pension funds and captive pools of capital, like insurance companies, et cetera. They're really the primary investors. You know, in the U.S., you have a much more diversified investor base. The last point I would say is that yields. Any real estate investor is, you know, very focused on the yield. And yields are much higher in Latin America. So where REITs in the U.S. yield somewhere in the 3 to 4% range, in Latin America, they range from 6 to 12%. And there's some different reasons for that. You know, like in Brazil, the real yields are very high. You know, interest rates are still very high, even though they're in a rate cut cycle. They're still very high. In Mexico, and we can talk about this a little bit later, you know, the currency kind of took a beating. And so yields there on income-producing assets like REITs, they moved up from like a 4 to 6 range up to like 6 to 9. And so, you know, yields are much higher in LATAM, and I think that's an important distinction for, you know, potential investors to consider when looking at the asset class.
So kind of expanding on that, what are some factors you're predicting will affect housing in real estate in this market in 2017? Do they differ than what is being forecasted here in the U.S.?
They do. And so the number one difference is, you know, Latin America remains chronically undersupplied from a housing standpoint. You're going to find that in most emerging economies. There's just a large pent-up demand for modern housing. And so there's this permanent opportunity from a housing standpoint to deliver more product. Now, what's happened over the last probably 5, 6, 7 years is, number one, the housing market in particular submarkets, you know, especially in contrasting Brazil and Mexico, has gone through some unique challenges. And that mainly has to do with the ability for private lenders to operate efficiently in the marketplace. In other words, you know, you saw private lenders, banks like in Brazil, pull back substantially when the recession started really accelerating over the last 3 years. Now, Brazil is expected to grow by the end of this year. There are some very constructive macro improvements occurring. And so there's a lot of expectation that the non-subsidized part of the housing market, so that would be, you know, middle income, upper middle income, that we're going to see an acceleration in growth in Brazil. In Mexico, it's a similar situation. Although I would say Mexico is probably a few years ahead of Brazil in terms of the health of its housing market. All of that said, there is a big difference in Latin America versus the U.S. in terms of the low-income housing market. In both the cases of Brazil and Mexico, and this is generally true throughout Latin America, there is a fairly robust permanent government subsidy program as it relates to low-income housing. So even if the macro picture is not so great, and that might be negatively impacting the middle-income housing market, because the government has these attractive low-income housing credit programs in place, you typically don't see much of a change on the low-income housing front. It's just sort of gradually but predictably growing.
So switching gears a little bit here, I want to talk about Mexico's real estate market more specifically. It's one of the biggest regions in Latin America, obviously, and the new Trump administration has had plenty to say about our neighbors to the south. Is this rhetoric affecting this market at all?
So this is everybody's focus, right? And I think, you know, for some very good reasons. I mean, during the election last year, during the general election, we heard just tremendous rhetoric that was quite negative regarding Mexico and, more importantly, the U.S.'s willingness to remain in NAFTA. When Trump was elected in November, you know, we saw a sort of a swift and sudden depreciation of the Mexican currency. I would say that the primary impact back in November was really on the currency. That was it. The Mexican economy has done nothing but march forward, and we believe that the medium-term and certainly long-term fundamentals are intact. Anecdotally, I'll tell you guys a little story. So I did, I think, a Wall Street Journal piece like a week before the election, and this was the question, right? You know, how is Trump going to impact Mexico? And our quote was, it's just a bunch of election year hooey, and they printed it. And so, of course, Trump gets elected, the peso dives like, you know, 10-11%. And I was looking at it going, well, you know, the timing could have been better. But I will tell you, we have completely retraced that entire currency sell-off, right? And the Mexican currency is the number one currency year-to-date in the world. And all we've seen is a steady pulling back from all of that rhetoric. So, you know, on the wall, right? I mean, we saw what happened there, right? I mean, the wall's not even going to get built. I mean, much less funded by Mexico. It appears that even Congress is unwilling to fund it, right? And that's after we recognize that there are already many, many walls along the U.S.-Mexican border, right? So that issue seems to have been taken off the table. The second issue with NAFTA, you know, it's pretty clear to us now that not only is the U.S. not going to pull back from NAFTA, but that NAFTA could, in fact, serve as a framework for expanded trade relationships. Could be with Brazil, Argentina, Chile. Sunday night, there was a piece in the Financial Times that actually spoke directly to Mexico's interest in discussing an expansion of NAFTA in the context of the TPP framework with China. Right. So we actually think it's the opposite case at the end of the day that the evidence is suggesting. But certainly whatever impact that the Trump election had back in, you know, late 2016, the markets have gone the other direction. And we actually think that the relationship with Mexico could be even more constructive going forward than it was under Obama's two terms.
So just to clarify, do you think the wall or Trump's plan or pending plan to build the wall, like, has had any effect on Mexico's real estate market?
No, nothing really directly on the real estate market. So, I mean, I think that, you know, currencies are going to move, right? And
okay.
So obviously, you know, if the currency sells off 10%, right, it makes real estate more attractive, right? As I mentioned before, you know, before
okay.
the election, REITs were yielding like 4-6% in Mexico. Well, now they're like 6-9%, right? So if you think about that, from an income investor's perspective, like, you wanted to be buying, right? And mm-hmm. the nice thing is that fundamentally Mexican REITs are growing dividends by mm-hmm. about 15% a year. So not only are you getting a better yield, but you're acquiring a really attractive growth profile, right? Direct on real estate. My concern after the election was more about trade than anything else, because if trade was in fact going to be changed in a way that would be negative for Mexico, yes, there would have been direct impact on some segments, some property types in Mexico, especially industrial. But that's not the case.
So getting even more specific here, where do you think are the biggest opportunities in real estate for investors? In your opinion, which cities in Latin America and in even the U.S., if you have highlighted some, are the best to buy real estate right now?
So here's the conundrum with core, right? So core real estate would be like a stabilized office building or a stabilized industrial building, right? Where there's no construction risk, minimal lease-up risk. You're really buying an asset to operate it and receive that income. Core returns, and this is not a Latin America thing, this is a global thing, right? Core returns have converged with public returns, meaning that if you're an investor in the core class, right, you're better off buying an equity because you got the liquidity, right? You buy a building, you know, if you're getting, let's say, 50 to 100 basis points more yield, you're probably going to lose that differential through the fact that you're illiquid, right? So there's a cost to transact, to buy and sell that property. There's a timing cost. And so, you know, if your yields between public and private core real estate are de minimis, you're better off being in a liquid vehicle, right? You could call your broker the next day and sell it, okay? When we talk about the opportunities, it's really in the development space. And there it gets much trickier, right? Because number one, you have to be a very different kind of investor, willing to take on a very different risk profile. And lastly, you can't just fly in and do it yourself. You have to do it with a local partner, right? So there is institutional money looking at doing that. So the property types that, and I'll talk about some areas, property types that I think are quite interesting. In Mexico, it's, again, very, very early innings, but apartment buildings, so multifamily. Culturally, you couldn't have really done an institutional-grade apartment building in Mexico 10 years ago, just because kids would get out of college and, you know, they would still live with their parents until they were married, and then they would go get a house, right? Now, you've seen a cultural shift where kids want to live on their own, right? So you have this interesting demand from millennials. Secondly, in Mexico, the rise of, you know, so the reemergence of the middle class and upwardly mobile middle class. These professionals want to rent something because they don't know if they're going to be moving from Mexico City to Monterrey or to Guadalajara for their next career opportunity. In other words, they don't have kids. They're not ready to settle down and own a home. So I think multifamily in Mexico is going to be a very interesting story. In Brazil, we watch commercial retail, so like shopping malls very closely, and industrial. We think that office is a little oversupplied, I mean, quite competitive in Brazil, but we like the consumer profile in Brazil. We like where it's at now. We think that it's got very little downside at this point and a substantial amount of upside, and Brazilians love to shop, right? It's one of the most attractive consumer profiles in the world from a shopping standpoint. They like to spend money. Industrial is interesting in Brazil because of the yields. They're very high, right? So if you can accept the risk, you can build into like a 10, 11, 12% cap rate market all day long. And it's a question of waiting for those opportunities to come along on the tenant side. To give you an example, you know, industrial in the U.S. is probably like in the 6, maybe 7%, 6% and below range, right? So you're getting double the yield in a place like Brazil.
Certainly a lot to think about there. Thank you again for joining us. Some really insightful commentary and something I think our listeners will learn a lot from.
Yeah, I know I did.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I thank you guys. It's been great spending some time with you.